One in four American adults has been diagnosed with a mental illness. That's according to the National Institute of Mental Health. Over the next hour, we'll hear from some of those living with a mental illness, with families, parents, and caregivers, as they talk about adapting to life after that diagnosis.
When I'm depressed, I'll usually say that I have the flu or a cold or a migraine, so I can stay in but not tell them that I'm depressed.
People are ignored and sometimes even shunned because of the breaking of the brain. Every person, every child, does not ask for this disease.
They shouldn't give ownership to it. They shouldn't let it control their lives. There is help. There's a bright, shining light at the other end of the dark tunnel.
I'm Scott Cameron. Unmet needs, living with mental illness in Central Illinois. That's coming up after this news. This is Illinois Public Media. I'm Scott Cameron. Thanks for joining us for Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. Over the next hour, we'll hear about some of the barriers to accessing regular care. We'll explore efforts to improve mental health care for children and for college students. And we'll discuss the ongoing battle against stigma. First, we begin where it starts for many people, with the diagnosis. For many, it can take 6 months or more to get that first appointment with a psychiatrist. According to federal labor statistics, there are more psychiatrists working in Illinois than in most states. The bulk of that service concentrated in the Chicago area. But mental health providers say there are major gaps in service across the state of Illinois. That's especially true downstate. Sean Powers looks at the challenges facing psychiatric services and some of the potential solutions.
27-year-old Zach Medlin of Champaign didn't start hearing the voices until about 7 years ago when he was a student at the University of Illinois.
I started thinking that there are secret messages in my emails that people are sending me, that I could decode them and read their thoughts. I started thinking that people were reading my thoughts. I imagined that my friends were all talking to me in my head. I thought that I was the chosen one, chosen by God to lead people to justice in the apocalypse.
Zach started showing signs of depression when he was 18, but he says his schizophrenia began taking shape when he was in college. He had been diagnosed with ADHD and was taking Adderall. Over the last few years, he says he's talked with gods, demons, angels, and ghosts, and he's had visits from extraterrestrials.
Now I believe that I hear from the voice of God himself. And I believe that he got me to stop smoking, and he's beginning me to stop drinking so much and make more friends, all kinds of stuff. Sometimes I get the voice of the devil too, but I've learned to distinguish which one's which.
How do you do that?
Well, if I hear a voice that says to go kill yourself, that would be from satanical.
After giving school a try at the U of I and Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, but not graduating, Zach is now living at home in Champaign with his family. He's been hospitalized several times since his diagnosis and is focused on getting better. And he says he has support to do that through religion and family.
We're very proud of you. You could have found easier way out, and you've taken the high road.
That's Zach's mom, Deborah. She's become a real advocate for her son, even participating in the local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. In 2007, she tried to schedule a visit for Zach to see a psychiatrist at Carl Hospital in Urbana, and was told it would be 3 to 4 months before a doctor could see him. Before that could happen, he had a crisis and needed to be hospitalized.
If he'd seen the doctor earlier, when I had first called, or when I was started to explain that things like rolling around on the roof were dangerous, then it wouldn't have escalated to the point of him being hospitalized.
Deborah started looking for a psychiatrist for her son in major cities, where there are more of them on staff and shorter wait times. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, around 60% of Illinois psychiatrists are based in the Chicagoland area. Zach ultimately went with a psychiatrist 3 hours away in the St. Louis area. If Zach were to start seeing a psychiatrist at Carl today, he'd have to schedule as a new patient, and the hospital says it's currently booking first-time psychiatric patients 6 months out.
Since my experience at Carl, that has only expanded over time.
That's Arthur Traugott, who's one of 10 psychiatrists at Carl Hospital. He's been at the hospital for more than 40 years, and he says the long wait times are
primarily because of a shortage of other psychiatric services in the community. Our program here at Carl has continued to grow over the years, but has not kept up with the demand for our services.
According to a report by the Association of American Medical Colleges, more than half of psychiatrists are at least 55 years old. That means they're getting closer to retirement. The records also show the number of psychiatrists dropped slightly over a five-year period. Traugott has one solution.
I keep working in retirement. That's what I've been doing.
While there is a concern about shortages with these providers, the number of U.S. medical student seniors matched into psychiatry residencies has gone up in the last couple of years. But even with more people entering the field, mental health providers in Illinois say insufficient funding and low Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates are making it difficult to keep up care. Community Elements, the mental health center in Champaign County, has been forced to cut back on its services over the last decade. It's gone from having seven psychiatrists, some who are part-time, to what it is today, which is a full-time and part-time psychiatrist. Wait times for an initial visit with a psychiatrist can take at least 6 months. Community Elements CEO Sheila Ferguson says her agency is doing the best it can with the money that's available.
We wouldn't be able to do it without some funding from our state. And so that's what's been really critical in the last few years as the state has cut funding. We are now at a point where if they go to this next budget session and cut, it could really jeopardize the current level that we have.
Ferguson says problems with funding have also made it difficult to recruit psychiatrists in Champaign County. Carl psychiatrist Arthur Traugott says that's a problem that goes beyond physicians in his field.
Other things that are being put into practice are the use of mid-level practitioners in psychiatry, psychiatric nurses who have had special training in the field. However, we have been trying to recruit at Carl, and we find them very difficult to entice them to come to this community.
That can lead to a shortage of mental health care providers, which too often leaves patients, like Zach Medlin, in the emergency room for mental health care. Here again is his mom, Deborah.
When he was ill, we needed somebody then. We couldn't wait weeks and months. The emergency room was not what Zachary wanted to do. He wanted to see his psychiatrist.
With the shortages in mental health care, some agencies are more selective about who can see a psychiatrist. For example, at Francis Nelson Health Center in Champaign, Nancy Greenwald, who oversees the clinic, says patients can't just call to schedule an appointment with the clinic's part-time psychiatrist. They have to be referred by a primary care doctor.
Our psychiatrist does consulting with all our primary care providers. She has for a long time, but what we've done recently is we have a monthly meeting where providers can bring in cases, our psychiatrist can work with all the primary care providers, and that way we can meet some of the need, some of the more manageable cases at the primary care level.
Greenwald says that staves off long wait times, which at Francis Nelson are typically 3 to 5 weeks for an initial visit. Daniel Johanna served as the president of the Illinois Psychiatric Society. He says that kind of model where different physicians are communicating is a good idea.
Most people who have mental health problems, again, depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, are in primary care, more than 85%. A small percentage who are severely ill and require more of a system of care should be treated within the mental health system within the states.
The shortages in mental health care are particularly noticeable in rural communities, like in Mason County in western Illinois, where the hospital there has had trouble recruiting a psychiatrist. According to federal data from the early 90s that the government continues to use, more than half of the nation's counties have no practicing psychiatrists, psychologists, or social workers. All of those communities are rural. Harry Wolin is the administrator at Mason District Hospital, which serves a county of fewer than 15,000 people. That's much less than Champaign County, but Wolin says the two communities share a common challenge, attracting psychiatrists.
Recruitment into a rural area is very challenging because of the unique nature. It's finding someone who enjoys the lifestyle of not having a mall on every street corner and living in a community where there aren't the sorts of amenities that typically are found in urban areas.
So the hospital looked for other ways to provide that care. Enter telepsychiatry. A psychiatrist meets with a patient through a remote video connection, sort of like Skyping with your doctor. The Mason District Hospital uses this technology for both children and adults. Woolen says it's more expensive because of the equipment, internet connection, and extra staff to be in the room during a session, but he says it's worth it.
It's very important to the community, very expensive to the hospital, but in balance, that's why we're here. is to meet the needs of the community.
Telepsychiatry is covered by Medicaid, but not all private insurers. A bill in the Illinois legislature seeks to change that. The mental health center in rural Douglas County serves a diverse community, including Latinos and the Amish. It's lost all of its funding from the county and now relies on 95% of its support from Medicaid reimbursements. Mental Health Executive Director Jan Aiden says her agency used telepsychiatry for children, but stopped a couple of years ago.
I think that you lose a lot of opportunities to recognize symptoms and emotions when you don't have a person-to-person meeting. And that's my opinion, but it's also what our parents of our clients, they were frustrated. They didn't feel the connection with the psychiatrist.
Aiden says the Douglas County Mental Health Center did away with telepsych, referring patients to other providers, even volunteering to drive them if transportation is an issue. She does have an adult psychiatrist who came out of retirement and works at the mental health center 14 hours a month. She actually picks him up from Champaign and takes him to the mental health center 30 minutes away. Your doctor is nearing 70 years old, and he's not going to be able to do this forever. What's going to happen when he puts in the towel and says, you know, I have to retire a second time?
I will make every effort to find a psychiatrist that is willing to come in and meet our patients face to face. It's probably inevitable that eventually we will have to go to the telepsychiatry, but that is an absolute last resort for us.
Meeting the needs of community while balancing cost and care is something many healthcare providers are struggling with as the demand for mental health service continues to grow. I'm Sean Powers.
In Sean's story, we heard from 27-year-old Zach Medlin of Champaign. He was 18 when he started showing signs of depression. Over the last few years, he says he's talked with gods, demons, angels, and ghosts, even had visits from extraterrestrials, he says. His mom, Deborah, says caring for Zach and helping him live with his illness has not been easy on either of them. We asked both to sit down and talk with each other about their experience.
When I first looked at you, when all the other babies were tucked away in the nursery, you were still wide awake. You were very visually on cue with my face. And I could just remember saying, oh, you're going to take me from one end of the emotional spectrum to the other, not realizing how that predictable that was going to be. What is your mental illness, Zach?
I don't have a mental illness, Mom. I mean, I'm not going to define myself by that.
What do the voices in your head say?
They usually tell me a lot of positive things. They tell me, sometimes they tell me it's the end of the world, that the apocalypse is coming. And they tell me that I'm one of the 144 chosen from all the tribes of Israel. And they tell me the current president is the Antichrist. And that I play some small role in the world affairs that are to come. They're mostly benign. They tell me jokes, really, really funny jokes that I could never make up. And they take me on cosmic adventures to time and space, even though I have not even left my room.
What's been the biggest lesson you've learned since being diagnosed? And who's been the greatest help for you along the way?
The fact that I can make it through this. If I can quit smoking cigarettes, I can do anything. My greatest help has probably been the church and my mom, you. The church, because my spirituality is really tied to my illness. Even though I try not to think of it as my illness, because if you give it ownership over you, it'll just dominate you. So I try not to give my illness any ownership over me. How do you describe my mental illness when you talk to other people about me?
It depends. Sometimes I will just say that the people will say, well, what is your son doing? And I'll say he's at home. And sometimes just say he has some problems. Other times, if I'm feeling more comfortable, I'll say that you have a mental illness. Recently, it's been easier to say you're a person that has an illness called schizophrenia. So I'm very open about it because, Zach, we're proud of you. We're proud of you and think you're the bravest person we have ever known because you put up with this day in, day out.
What have been the happiest, saddest moments of your life since I've been diagnosed?
The saddest moment was watching you walk toward the hospital mental ward doors, seeing how brave you were and seeing the doors locked behind you. The greatest moments of your illness have been those days when the medication allows you to be more like yourself with your humor, your love of books, your love of movies, your ability to have conversations. One of the greatest days of my life was coming home and you were on the porch reading a book and you said, "Mom, I want to go to the bookstore and get a book," because Zach, you were gifted in the literary areas and you hadn't picked up a book in years. What do you want people to learn about mental illness, Zach?
That there is help, that there's a bright shining light at the other end of the dark tunnel, and that to hang on and that help is on the way. Recovery is possible. Are you proud of me?
Do you need to ask?
It's in the...
We're very proud of you. You could have found easier way out, and you've taken the high road. I just want to thank you for breathing.
Zach and Deborah Medlin interviewed each other about living with Zach's mental illness. As we mentioned earlier, Zach's schizophrenia started taking shape when he was in college at the University of Illinois. Colleges and universities continue to see growing demand for mental health services. In our next story, Ryan Weber reports that budgets and staffing levels for most campus counseling centers aren't keeping up with that demand.
University of Illinois student Han Lindahl started to develop her anxiety in high school. It went untreated, and during her first years of college, the anxiety grew, and so did the binging, and she started
counting calories, tabulating things, pacing around the dining hall, kind of waiting alone, waiting for times that I could eat alone, making spreadsheets of what I was eating.
Then Lindahl hit her breaking point. She first went to the U of I Counseling Center for help.
I somehow expected the desperation that I felt to be matched in quick action by them, and that wasn't necessarily the case.
After three sessions, the center gave her a list of recommended psychiatrists in Champaign-Urbana. What followed were several weeks of insurance issues, paperwork, and initial appointments. That's because university counseling centers tend to function more as transfer stations, either helping students to move to a more specialized care provider in the community or to quickly shift back to college life. But if students have an emergency, most college counseling center directors say someone will see them within minutes. At U of I, the center is limited in the services it can offer, though. Here's U of I's Counseling Center Director, Carla McCowan.
By and large, just like most counseling, college counseling centers, we are a short-term facility. We can't see every student who comes into us long-term.
With tight budgets and limited staffing, university counseling centers are outsourcing students to local healthcare providers if an issue can't be resolved in a handful of sessions. At U of I, McCowan says walk-in and emergency appointments have nearly tripled over the last 4 years. For many people, mental health conditions and illness develop while they're in college. 3 years ago, anxiety overtook depression as the most common mental health condition or illness that college counseling centers treat. Sandy Kolbs is the director of the counseling center at Illinois State University, and she says not all of the cases of anxiety her center sees require psychiatric care.
We're noticing that that anxiety is not necessarily a clinical type of anxiety as much as it is students reaching the threshold where they feel that they need help to cope more quickly than in the past.
What counseling centers treat most often are cases of, say, students stressing out about an exam or weathering a bad breakup, which are issues that could still require monitoring. Elizabeth Gongai is the president of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. She says these issues can be the first signs of something larger, which could require years of counseling and psychiatric care.
More than a quarter, sometimes as much as a third of the students who come to the counseling center have had previous treatment of some kind to address a mental health issue.
U of I student Carly Supernon has been seeing mental health professionals since she was in the third grade. She has high levels of anxiety and depression, and there are days when she'll wake up and feel so depressed that she'll lie in bed all day. But she says a lot of people she knows don't know this about her, except for maybe her closest friends and family. And as she's told her doctor back home, often no one even suspects.
My outside personality is like pretty, you know, outgoing, like seems fine. And I was like, but inside, it doesn't match up with that. And I said, what I want is for my inside thoughts to feel confident as like I seem on the outside, if that makes sense.
Because she's developed a strong relationship with her doctor, she says she doesn't want to find a closer doctor at school. So she'll call or even text her doctor back home in Chicago if she's ever feeling overwhelmed, anxious, or depressed about virtually anything. While Carly's doctor diagnosed her with a mental illness, Gongai says that's not necessarily the case for the thousands of other college students who seek out services on campus.
The vast majority of students who come into counseling centers are not mentally ill, but they may have symptoms that are really troubling.
Adding to the importance of the center, she says, is that this may be the first time people have had access to some form of mental health care. If you're from a rural area, the nearest mental health care provider could be as much as 60 miles away. Or this might be the first time students felt like they were away from stigma at home and can finally seek out help on their own. And that was the case for Han Lindahl. She dealt with her anxiety and binge eating on her own for so long that she couldn't take it anymore. She wasn't feeling like herself, and she needed help now.
I mean, I think at the time I was kind of feeling desperate. I think I even cried. I just was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this to myself. I need help. And I don't want all of my college experience and then some to just be this.
And as more students who feel this way seek out mental health care on campus, demand grows and counseling centers will see their resources stretched out even thinner. I'm Ryan Weber.
Getting access to mental health care while away at college can be a challenge for many students. Research shows that's especially true among Latinos on campus. Mental health care providers say cultural barriers can prevent many from seeking out mental health counseling. Federal data shows the problem is worse for full-time Latino college students. As Amanda Tagati reports, a new program at the University of Illinois' Urbana-Champaign campus aims to change that.
U of I medical student Franklin Cabrero first experienced symptoms of anxiety in 2012. A graduate student at the time, he was overwhelmed by pressures from school and family. Cabrero lost his academic advisor and was worried about his future. Then his grandma in Puerto Rico had a stroke.
And I just wasn't feeling right. It felt different. I couldn't sleep. You know, I didn't get hungry. I was losing weight. I started like staying at home more.
The pressures triggered panic attacks, burnout, and anxiety. U of I counselor Alejandro Gomez says Latino students often face additional stress compared to other students.
I run across a lot of Latinos that had the responsibilities of paying bills, their parents' and family's bills while growing up because a lot of their parents are immigrants and they don't speak English.
Data from the Department of Health and Human Services from 2008 shows Latinos over the age of 18 are less likely to receive mental health treatment or counseling than the general public. Gomez says culture and pride often prevent Latino students from reaching out for help.
When we're raised, it's very much stigmatized within the family. And we're raised that, hey, any issues that you have, you got to keep it within the family. Don't talk to any kind of strangers. Don't talk to anybody that, you know, you don't really know. Because it kind of serves as a kind of vergüenza or, you know, a kind of shame or it's embarrassing to the family.
We come across a lot of students like this, and we need to do something about it.
That's Alicia Rodriguez, an academic advisor at the Department of Latino Studies. To help students like Cabrero, the department teamed up with La Casa Cultura Latina and created the Latino-Latina Resilience Network. The semester-long program was designed to build a peer-to-peer support system where students learn about and raise awareness of available mental health resources on and off the campus. Veronica Khan is La Casa's assistant director and has worked alongside Rodriguez. She says one issue is that some Latino students and their families are unaware of mental health services.
If you look at the neighborhoods that many of our students are coming from, they're underserved neighborhoods. There's not a lot there. So the families themselves don't have a lot of exposure to these kinds of systems.
That makes it difficult for students to recognize mental health problems and know where to turn for help. Khan says this program creates a safe space for Latino students to open up to each other.
Social networks are really important to being resilient or to be able to academically succeed in an institutional setting, particularly in a predominantly white institutional setting.
Franklin Cabrero, the medical student, says that being Latino on a mostly white campus adds another layer of pressure.
Some people are going to believe that you didn't deserve to be there, that you're here, especially for African Americans and Latino students, that we're here because of affirmative action or because of minority funding. So there's all those perceptions of, you know, put extra pressure in demonstrating, no, I am here because I deserve to be here.
That can be tough for counselors, teachers, and administrators to understand if they haven't experienced it themselves. Javi Ramirez is a U of I student and a coordinator for the Resilience Program.
At times, there's this
lack of cultural competency on the part of the university for students of color coming in. And, you know, they don't understand that in Latino culture, you know, if your mom gets sick, you know, you better be there like in 2 hours, right? Like, it's not an excuse. If someone's in the hospital and your immediate family, you just don't stay on campus. It's something within our culture that you go back and you're there for them.
Ramirez says taking the clinical aspect out of seeking mental health care is one of the main objectives of the program.
Talking about mental health is stigmatized in general. You get me? So, like, you tell someone to go to the counseling center, their first reaction is going to be like, well, I'm not crazy. You know, I'm not having my breakdown at 3 p.m, you know, after class. I'm having it at 2 a.m. while studying with other students. So then who am I going to talk to at 2 a.m? The students I'm with. You get me? So it's kind of like empowering students to have these conversations.
And that's the type of support Franklin Cabrero says students need. He says getting help is a step he made on his own, but it isn't a journey to be made alone. That's what Khan and Rodriguez hope students in this program learn, so that they can overcome their personal and cultural barriers together. I'm Amanda Tagati.
While many people develop a mental illness while in college, it's not uncommon for symptoms to start showing up much earlier. Coming up, we'll look at what's being done to improve mental health care for children and support for families, and we'll look into the role that stigma can play following a diagnosis. I'm Scott Cameron. This is Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. Welcome back. You're listening to Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. I'm Scott Cameron. Before the break, we heard about the challenges of addressing mental health needs on college campuses. Symptoms can often develop much earlier. According to research, half of all lifetime cases of mental illness begin by the age of 14. Federal data shows that a smaller percentage of Illinois children get the mental health care they need compared to the national average. Healthcare professionals say part of the problem is a lack of resources and parents not knowing where to turn for help. Sean Powers reports on what's being done to improve care for children.
There's no silver bullet when it comes to raising a child with mental illness. Just ask Troy and Violet of Rantoul in Champaign County. They've asked not to use their last name to protect the privacy of their children.
I'd say we're still in the middle of the test. We're still going through questions and answer period. You know, multiple choices every day of what do you do? Something new comes up just about every day.
Troy and Violet have both been diagnosed with mental illness, and their 13-year-old son Andrew has ADHD, bipolar disorder, and oppositional defiant disorder. He also has a minor form of autism, which is a behavioral condition. Violet says she knew Andrew was smart, even at a young age, but she says there were signs of problems. From 2 years old on, his tantrums didn't stop.
We went to terrible threes, to terrible fours, to terrible fives, and so on and so on and so on.
Andrew loves to draw, and he's pretty good at it, too. Inside his bedroom, there's a sketch on the wall of his favorite band called Skillet. Violet and Troy say there's one song in particular that he likes.
Oh, he would like the song Monsters. He would always call himself a monster because he didn't understand what he was feeling.
He didn't understand the emotions he was feeling inside, so he classified it as the monster inside himself.
Later on, Violet talks to Andrew about the song.
What I notice about you, Andrew, since you don't listen to that Skillet and some of their musics that they had, like Monster, that you don't call yourself a monster. You have not called yourself a monster for a long time.
I still do.
You never share it.
I don't have to share it.
Violet and Troy say communicating with Andrew can be a challenge. On top of addressing their own mental health needs, Troy says he and his wife are also left with a lot of questions, like what medications are the right fit for Andrew, and how to get him the extra help that he needs at school. Troy and Violet often struggle and hope their experience can help others in a similar situation. This year, they began teaching a 6-week course for parents and guardians raising a child with a mental illness. It was developed by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI.
My name is Terry Brister, and I work for NAMI.
Terry Brister developed the program in 2007, and it's now being taught in more than 36 states. She says the class helps parents understand how to navigate through the youth mental health care system. They also learn about the biology of the illnesses, symptoms, and behavioral management. Brister says there's no simple solution to raising a child with a mental illness, which is why the class doesn't just focus on one condition, but many conditions and how those associated symptoms overlap. While every experience is different, Brister says the challenges families face are often the same.
To be the caregiver of someone with a mental illness can be overwhelming, on top of the stresses of also being a parent, and most of the time there are other children in the home. So it's not uncommon at all to see parents develop their own symptoms of depression and anxiety, even if they didn't have those before.
Brister says because of the stigma tied to mental illness, there's added pressure put on parents.
Mental illnesses aren't casserole illnesses. If somebody breaks their leg or you know, has a heart bypass or whatever, the community brings over food. They may come and mow your yard. If they find out our child has been hospitalized because of emotional disturbances, they don't know what to say to us.
The pressures of raising a child with mental illness have led some parents to relinquish control of their kids to DCFS in what's known as psychiatric lockout. DCFS spokeswoman Karen Hawkins says it's happening because there's a lack of community mental health services for children. She says cases in which parents decide to go this route have doubled in the last couple of years.
Usually we're seeing this in cases where the children do require residential mental health services because that's obviously the most expensive, it's the most intensive. We're seeing a lot of cases where the children have become a danger to themselves or to other members of the family, and the family doesn't know what to do, and they can't afford the kind of care that the children need.
Data from the National Survey of Children's Health shows the percentage of children in Illinois who needed mental health services during the course of a year but didn't get those services is higher than the national average. According to an analysis by the American Academy of Child Adolescent Psychiatry, there are approximately 8,300 practicing child and adolescent psychiatrists in the U.S., which the group says isn't enough to meet the need. Deanne Ryan oversees the Vermilion County Mental Health Board. She says mental health services in Illinois need to be more centralized.
Often families have no idea where to turn. And our services are so fragmented and siloed and funded siloed that if a family has a problem and they call one agency, they might not fit within their funding guidelines, so they send them off to another agency, and pass the family around until they just get tired and give up.
There's a new pilot program in 4 central Illinois counties that looks at creating a more centralized mental health care system, like what Deanne Ryan was just talking about. DCFS contracts with the Indiana-based Choices program. The way it works is a care coordinator with Choices meets with a child who's a ward of DCFS and whoever is taking care of that child to put together a blueprint and support team. The blueprint may include getting that child into a foster home, after-school program, or seeing a therapist. Todd Schroll oversees the program in Illinois, and he says by localizing care, there should be less of a burden on the state's mental health care system.
We should be preventing young people from going into higher levels of care if at all possible. They should be stable in homes with the supports that they need so that they're not moving between multiple homes within short periods of time or even longer periods of time. We should be creating stability for them in this community by wrapping these services around them.
Schroll says the Choices program will also provide support to families who are in need of services that aren't Medicaid eligible. His care coordinators are being trained to become more culturally competent so that they can work with children of many different backgrounds. He's also in talks with Troy and Violet about incorporating their NAMI class as an option for families in need of mental health care training.
But here is my son's bedroom, Zachariah, and as you can tell, it's a mess.
Back at Troy and Violet's home in Rantoul, I get a tour of their youngest son's bedroom. While their oldest son, Andrew, has already been diagnosed with several types of mental illness, they say their youngest son, 7-year-old Zachariah, is the only one in the family who hasn't been diagnosed with a mental illness. But research shows that could change in the next few years. Troy says last year, Zachariah began keeping track of his family's behavior, marking each day of a calendar with different colors, like green for when things are going really well, or red when there's no one in the household who's getting along.
Red days was a very bad day. Flare-ups, blow-ups from usually the oldest son blowing up over something. And then everybody then getting into turmoil in the household over that.
And it's not always our son, you know.
We do it ourselves. We have our own flare-up.
It's those moments that not only test them as parents, but also as a family, and reinforce their commitment to help other families dealing with mental illness. I'm Sean Powers.
Some 20 miles from Troy in Violet, we found Rich and Holly Brandt. They dedicate their lives to raising awareness and refusing to give in to stigma or labels associated with their mental illness.
I'm deemed by a psychiatrist as a lost cause.
Life didn't turn out the way Rich Brandt thought it would.
It's basically trying to find the right combination of meds to help me feel better.
Rich has a mental illness.
I have schizoaffective disorder.
He told his story earlier this year to a group of students taking a mental health nursing course at Parkland College in Champaign.
I like to call it a relative of schizophrenia.
It's a psychological disorder that resembles schizophrenia and serious mood conditions like depression or bipolar disorder. Rich says he sometimes gets angry and sees and feels spiders crawling up on him that aren't really there.
I always hear a voice in my head telling me bad things, like people are after me or to commit suicide. Sometimes I have homicidal thoughts, but I really don't act on them. I'm not the type of person to do something to hurt somebody, but it's in my head.
In those moments, he distracts himself by going online or watching TV. Rich tells the class he takes about 10 pills in the morning, another 10 at night, just to, as he says, be even.
My question is, if you saw me walking down the street, would you notice that I have mental illness? You know, the thing is, I'm worried that you do. I'm worried about if people can see right through me and see my mental illness.
One person who doesn't just see his mental illness is his wife, Holly.
My name is Holly Brandt, and I do speaking for mental illness.
Holly has bipolar disorder. She and Rich are the same age, were diagnosed about a decade apart. The two met at the mental health center in Champaign County.
My favorite memory of you is when you wrote me a note and it said that you cared about me and that I should always talk to you if I needed anything or if I was feeling lonely or sad.
Holly says she understands what Rich goes through because of her own experiences dealing with bipolar disorder.
Sometimes I can recognize his symptoms, but it just depends what, you know, I'm thinking or what I'm going through during the day, so.
I always tell her to not worry about me, to worry about herself.
I'm married to him, and I am his wife, and I'm concerned about what he's feeling, and, you know, that's why we're so close and connected with each other and have an understanding of what we go through each day.
Rich and Holly are advocates for those with mental illness, but they didn't start out that way. When you walk into their apartment, the walls are filled with images and memories and dreams. Rich was a volunteer firefighter for more than a decade. He still collects reminders of his past. There's photos of Champaign Fire Department trucks. There's a poster of the 1991 film Backdraft and his volunteer firefighting badge from when he lived in Alabama. Now on disability because of his mental illness, he says he had to put that life behind him.
I still listen to the scanner. I still watch the fire trucks go by when they have a call. It's really, it's part of my life for a long time, and I really do miss it.
Holly's dream is to be a ballet dancer. She says she used to dance all the time.
You have to be in sync with the class you're dancing with, so it's not really hard, but it's, you know, my mental illness doesn't want to somehow get me motivated to do that again.
For now, the Brandts spend their lives in other ways, trying to reduce stigma and raise awareness. They're closely involved with the local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and they speak regularly with law enforcement and students about their experiences.
The thing is, I don't care about my mental illness. I care about other people's. That's why I speak to the colleges to educate them on mental illness.
Having a mental illness, of course, is not something you can cure overnight. It can stay with you for a lifetime. Robert Russell of Champaign enlisted in the Army shortly after starting college at the University of Illinois in the late 1960s. He says he needed the money. A few years later, when he was home on leave, he met his wife, Anne, on a blind date. In just a few days, they decided to marry and have stayed married for the last 42 years. Eventually, Robert returned home from the war, and like many who served in Vietnam, he started showing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. He was having flashbacks while at work. When Robert was officially diagnosed, he says it was devastating for him, but for Anne, it was a relief. They talked to each other about what happened with him in Vietnam and about living with Robert's PTSD.
In Vietnam, we got
embroiled in October, November of 69 in Plain Morong. My battalion took on 3 regiments of North Vietnamese Army regulars. We took about 80% casualties, and I essentially at that point made up my mind that I was just going to die. Matter of fact, it got to the point that I got bad enough that my company executive officer wouldn't let me go out in the field again because I was a danger to myself and other people.
How did you find out about your diagnosis?
I was working in a house on the second floor over a batch of Vietnamese living next door, and I had flashbacks. The doctor at Christie Clinic at the time diagnosed me as bipolar, but he left, and Dr. Crandall came along and changed it to PTSD. There aren't any really happy points in my life since I've been diagnosed, especially since I was diagnosed as 100% unable to work. That is the saddest point in my life, being told that I can't work anymore, that I'm not capable of working. I just sit by myself and read a book. I don't go out. There's nothing to be happy for, and it's just the way it is. What have been the happiest and saddest moments of your life since I've been diagnosed?
Well, I think actually, oddly enough, the happiest moment was when you were diagnosed as 100%, because I knew that I didn't have to worry about you anymore, trying to find a job and struggling, that we were going to have a decent income. The saddest moment, I think, were probably the times that you thought about killing yourself.
Well, how do you describe my mental illness when you talk to other people about me?
I say that you have post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam and you're 100% disabled. And I tell people that it is not something that is a weakness of character or anything, that trauma changes your brain structure, and it's not something that you can help. It's just your brain has been altered, and it's like having diabetes or heart disease or anything else. It's something that has a biological basis to it, and there's nothing that you have done that caused it. What's the biggest lessons you've learned since being diagnosed, and who's been the greatest help for you along the way?
Well, the greatest help has been from my current therapist. A lesson that I've learned from him is that combat PTSD is honorable. It's a war wound. It's not eligible for the Purple Heart because I didn't bleed for it. But it's a war wound, and as such, it should be honored. Is there anything that you've never told me you want to tell me now?
I don't think so. I think I pretty much tell you everything. Sometimes maybe I've ordered something online and I forgot to tell you. Now I think we pretty much share everything. Is there anything you've never told me but want to tell me now?
Just how much I love you. There are not words to express what you mean to me. You stood by me for 42 years through hell. I just don't have words to express.
Anne and Robert Russell of Champaign talked to each other about living with his post-traumatic stress disorder. When we hear about PTSD, oftentimes it's associated with veterans like Robert. But there are many people who have it for other reasons. That's the case for Joey Ramp of Mahomet in Champaign County. She was diagnosed with PTSD 2 years ago. It's from a combination of events, sexual abuse as a child, physical abuse in a marriage and an accident a few years ago. Large crowds and new places make her uneasy. It's her service dog, Theo, and her highly regimented schedule that help her handle her anxiety and cope with her PTSD. Joey Ramp says that diagnosis often leads to uncomfortable assumptions, both about her and her mental illness.
First time when I, you know, say I have PTSD, people say, oh, are you military? And, you know, most times they're ready to thank me for my service or whatever. And then I say, no, I was a victim of childhood rape and domestic abuse. And they, you know, they immediately look down and they look embarrassed and they say, oh, I'm sorry, under their breath. And what that does is that pushes guilt and shame back onto me. I'm far enough in my own recovery to, you know, to not let that happen. But if that's the first time that you've said that and you get that reaction, a lot of times that's really hard and you feel embarrassed or ashamed. And there's no reason to be.
That's a fairly common experience, according to Kay White. She's a behavioral science professor at Millikan University, and she tells me people often make assumptions about mental illness and people with mental illness, like Joey Ramp and what she just described.
I think likely that the jump now to a person with a service dog having PTSD and being part of the military is due to the increased awareness of our servicemen coming home with PTSD and some of the treatments that are being offered to them. So the communication or the media has been very specific about problems that our military men are experiencing and what some of the treatments are. I don't think we as a society have been as educated on other forms of mental health issues or other PTSDs as well as we have our military most recently.
You know, that awkwardness that we're talking about that launched this conversation, it comes from a place of people wanting to help, wanting to know what to say, and just not knowing that.
Right. You know, and as I thought about this more, I feel that's pretty symbolic of our society's non-knowledge about mental health issues. If you had a neighbor whose son had an acute appendicitis attack and was raced to the hospital one evening, you might go next door to your neighbor and say, oh my goodness, I see your son was taken to the hospital. How are things going? If I can let out your dog, if I can do something, just call me. I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we as a society have been socialized to know what to do with quote-unquote medical illnesses, but we haven't been socialized on how to respond appropriately to mental health issues. And because we separate mental health issues from quote-unquote medical issues, we make it awkward on ourselves.
Yeah. And I mean, it is hard. I, you know, I even think when I was talking to Joey, you know, is there a moment, do I say, well, I'm sorry that that happened? Do I say, you know, I didn't know what to say?
Absolutely. And it's because we learn our social skills from our families and our parents and those in the community around us. And mental health awareness really hasn't been, we don't have a long history of mental health awareness in our society. It really started in the 60s. It happened before then, but it wasn't common talk until the 60s or the 70s.
What changed there?
Well, policy-wise in the United States, President Kennedy, and then with his life shortened, President Johnson, started the conversations on community health treatment, mental health treatment, and the deinstitutionalization of people that had mental health and some other types of behavioral or developmental problems. They brought that topic out of the closet. Prior to the 60s, many times someone that had a mental health problem or even a developmental disability was institutionalized. They weren't seen as people to be part of traditional society.
So not only were these issues not talked about, the people who were affected by those issues were hidden.
Yes, they were hidden away in large institutions. And that started to be torn down with Kennedy. He had personal issues in his own family of mental health, depression, suicide attempts, alcohol and drug issues in his family. And I think he had an aunt that had Down syndrome. And so he started the conversation of bringing these issues out and made it okay to talk about. And then after his death, Lyndon Johnson and his Great Society Plan and the development of the Community Mental Health Center movement followed through with that. So it started the conversation, but we have a lot of years of misunderstanding of mental health issues and our knowledge. We know so much more medically about appendicitis or gastroenteritis than we do mental health diagnoses and causes. Mm-hmm. We're still learning about the brain.
So there's still a long way to go, both in terms of perceptions and the knowledge, it sounds like, of what
yes.
we know and understand.
And we were told socially, you know, don't look, don't ask, don't talk.
Mm-hmm. And that's
because that's rude.
Right. And that's a hard habit to break.
It is, but these are people, and they have an issue, an illness, something that they're working on, and we care about them. And so you say, I really don't understand much about that, but I'm sure glad your dog helps you.
So don't be afraid to say, look, I don't know what to do here. I don't know the perfect thing to say.
Exactly.
But I want you to know I care.
Yes. I think that is something that is helpful in so many situations when you don't know what to say.
Yeah. You know, we often see in headlines and in news stories and things like that, we try to be very aware of it, the word suffer related to mental illness, implying that there is suffering when some people will say, you know what, no, I've learned to live and thrive with this. I am not suffering from this. This does not own me.
It depends on your definition of suffering. Again, suffering is kind of a loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that at times people managing their mental health issues do have periods where they are uncomfortable, unhappy, feel bad. And if you would like to label that suffering, I think that's appropriate. But you don't suffer every day, 24 hours a day, as if you're in your last stages of terminal cancer.
Right. And that's one thing I guess I'm learning here from this conversation as well, is the series that we've done, is in many ways, you know, not labeling other people, allow them to determine the own words, their own words that describe their experience, rather than trying to plaster them with your own perceptions.
Absolutely. And just, I mean, they're people. Talk with them.
Right, you know? Exactly. Just like a broken leg, if somebody fell down, you'd say, hey, you doing okay? A similar kind of thing. That was Millikan University Behavioral Science Professor Kay White talking with me about the stereotypes that often exist of mental illness and those with a mental illness. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Unmet Needs, Living with Mental Illness in Central Illinois. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. The producers of our program are Sean Powers and Lindsay Moon. We had reporting assistance from Ryan Weber and Amanda Tagati. I'm Scott Cameron. For more on this series, visit will.illinois.edu/mental health.